Drive Time on RT Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. When it comes to pensions, performance counts. Speak to a financial broker about a Zurich pension.
Drive Time on RTE Radio 1.
Hamas launched a barrage of rockets and sent a wave of fighters who gunned down civilians.
A shocking hostage taking of more than 100 Israelis.
The military pounded the Palestinian enclave with airstrikes in the last 24 hours.
Now we argue about how many people are killed. I know the names of those people who were killed.
Hamas is using the houses of civilians in Gaza so he can shoot 1,000 missiles a day.
Electricity, food, water and gas supplies have been cut off.
Everything is running short, including the fuel for the generators.
Us as Israel, if we give our enemy fuel, they will abuse it.
They are fighting for war, they are fighting each other.
This is Israel's 9/11. 9/11.
On October the 7th, Hamas militants stormed across the Israeli border with Gaza. The attack killed 1,200 people and 251 were taken hostage. In response, Israel launched a military bombardment of Gaza. Palestinian health authorities say Israel's military campaign in Gaza has killed almost 42,000 people, mostly civilians, over the past year and driven most of Gaza's 2.3 million people from their homes.
Over four programmes, we will chronicle the year's events, from the Hamas attack to the ongoing war in Gaza and the real risk of Middle East conflict in the wider region. In this third episode, we focus on the 7th to the 9th month of the conflict, from May to July.
The threat of a ground offensive in Rafah looms large in these months. Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to enter Rafah and eliminate the Hamas battalion there, with or without a deal.
It eventually happens in limited form after the US say a full ground offensive would be a red line which could not be crossed. The International Court of Justice on the 24th of May ordered Israel to immediately halt its military offensive in Rafah.
Ceasefire negotiations proved fruitless with Hamas and Israel failing to reach agreement in Cairo, while civilian displacement, disrupted aid deliveries and constant bombardment caused an immense humanitarian crisis. As of July 2024, over 35,000 Palestinians had been killed, many of them civilians, and over 100 Israeli hostages are still held by Hamas.
This is part three of the war in Gaza. As we entered the month of May, the Israeli government continued their focus on an invasion of Rafah in the south of Gaza. Here's the Israeli government spokesperson, Avit Hyman, on the intentions of the Israeli government.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said today that its troops will enter the city of Rafah in southern Gaza to eliminate Hamas with or without a ceasefire deal and a hostage deal. He added that the option of ending the war before Israel has reached its objectives is not an option. I'm joined now by Avi Hyman, who's a spokesperson for the Israeli government. Mr. Hyman, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Colin. Thanks for having me on.
We've been hearing about ceasefire negotiations progress in the last few days, and we're awaiting a response from Hamas, we're told. But now this hardline statement from your Prime Minister about the attack on Rafah, how can the Rafah offensive still be an option in the context of ceasefire negotiations and in the context of international opposition to it?
Comic, our position hasn't changed from day one. Our objectives in this war are to destroy Hamas, to bring home the hostages, and to ensure that Gaza doesn't pose a threat to us in the future. Now, to do that, we will have to break up the last four battalions of Hamas, which is in Rafah. And I know that lots of people on the streets of Ireland and elsewhere are calling for ceasefire, but what we're currently trying to do is to negotiate for the release of those 133 Israeli hostages, men, women and children being held against their will, a crime against humanity. So we've done that in the past. We've said the precedent, and the precedent is the carrot and the stick, keeping up the military pressure against Hamas while at the same time using all diplomatic channels available to us. That's what we're continuing to do.
What if the threat of the attack on Rafah or the attack on Rafah hampers the hostage deal?
They're quite to the contrary. I mean, you can see that Hamas in recent days has released the first evident signs of life for multiple hostages, something they haven't done for most of the hostages throughout this period for over 200 days. So we see that Hamas is getting the message. They're understanding that the military pressure is still firmly on the table.
But not all hostages have been released, and not all hostages are alive, it's thought as well. So this is a huge risk, isn't it, for the Israeli Prime Minister and your government? If you attack Rafah, there's a real risk that those families that the Prime Minister is talking to in Israel will not get their loved ones back.
No, quite to the contrary. Like I said, we've already set the precedent that Hamas understands force. Hamas would gladly hold on to the hostages till kingdom come. They have no incentive to release the hostages unless they understand that they have what to lose.
UN Court in The Hague told Israel that it must take all measures within its power to desist from killing Palestinians in contravention of the Genocide Convention and to prevent and punish the incitement of genocide and facilitate the provision of urgent basic services. If Israel attacks Rafah, and we know that nearly 2 million people are trapped inside Rafah, there's a huge risk that innocent people will die. Could you not be in contravention of that order, interim order from the ICJ?
Absolutely not, Cormick. Cormick, we are fully consistent with our activities, fully consistent with international humanitarian law, as was stated recently by Rear Admiral John Kirby from the White House.
Human Rights Watch disagrees.
By Lord Cameron. I'm not going to get into the various NGOs that have sent you releases. I'm going to talk about the serious players on the world stage.
The US, the UN want you to show restraint in Rafah.
We will do our absolute utmost to ensure that we go after Hamas and limit civilian casualties in a way that no army has done in the history of modern warfare.
While the invasion of Rafah loomed, the humanitarian situation in Gaza further deteriorated. Doctors who work to help casualties in Gaza's diminishing number of functioning hospitals often returned home with horrific details. Like this interview from May with NHS consultant Dr. Junie Sultan.
The European Hospital in southern Gaza is the last major fully functioning hospital in the territory. And my next guest has just come back from working there for several weeks and said what he witnessed was sheer horror. Dr. Junie Sultan, an NHS consultant vascular surgeon, joins me now. Dr. Sultan, you're very welcome to the programme. Can I ask you why you went there, first of all?
A number of factors. So one of the most important factors was that, as you can see, that the healthcare facilities and healthcare workers are protected as per international humanitarian laws and Hague and Geneva Convention.
You said what you saw was sheer horror. So what types of injuries did you see, did you treat?
Actually, basically all sort of, basically the major impact of the injuries were as a direct result of the impact of the warfare injuries. So which included the gunshot and particularly the sniper shots. Around the blood vessels, particularly in the legs, arms, around the neck, in the at the level of the shoulder. So many, wherever the blood vessel is, and that could have a debilitating effect on the patient. Either they can bleed to death, and if survived, they could basically become crippled, essentially. Lots of injuries due to bombing and as a result of the shrapnels and massive burns. The second class, the tier of the patients was basically, the war has been going on for 6 months, and 36 hospitals being destroyed. And a lot of those patients who were treated in those hospitals, they were not able to go back. They could not have any follow-ups, lack of antibiotics, lack of painkillers, lack of food, weak, emaciated patients. So they had a very, very high risk and a very high rate of complications. So we had a quite huge number of patients who were actually living as a refugee within the hospital or outside the hospital in camps. And they have number of complications, whatever you could think of.
I think not just a number, just to give people an indication. I think there are
exactly
about 30,000 refugees on the grounds of the hospital. Isn't that right?
Absolutely correct. And then the third was something which we don't even think about, the normal day-to-day routine patients, particularly like diabetics, renal patients, cancer patients. For example, diabetic patients who normally, when they get any infection in their foot, and they could have just a 1 week course of antibiotics and they could be treated as an outpatient. And because of lack of antibiotics and being seen appropriately by anyone, so they were actually presenting with the flesh-eating bacteria, you call it as necrotizing fasciitis.
In May, the International Criminal Court prosecutor, Karim Khan, requested the court issue arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu and his defence minister, Yoav Gallant, over alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. We heard the Israeli response at the time.
The International Criminal Court's prosecutor has requested arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, his defence chief, as well as three Hamas leaders over alleged war crimes. ICC prosecutor Karim Khan said that after 7 months of war in Gaza, he had reasonable grounds to believe that these men bear criminal responsibility for alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity. Well, for some reaction to this news, I'm joined by Jonathan Turner, Chief Executive of Lawyers for Israel. Jonathan, you're very welcome indeed to the programme.
Well, thank you, Cormac. I'm glad to be on.
What's your reaction?
Well, I'm disappointed with the application to obtain arrest warrants against the Israeli ministers. I don't think there is any satisfactory basis for it, looking at such information as is available to me. And I very much suspect, from what I've read, that they've relied on UN reports that have been drafted by officials, as many of the UN officials are, who are bitterly prejudiced against Israel, very biased against Israel, and frankly, not very honest.
If I can stop you there, I've read Karim Khan's statement. He's the chief prosecutor at the ICC. He says, my office submits that the evidence we have collected, including interviews with survivors and eyewitnesses, authenticated video, photo and audio material, satellite imagery, and statements from the alleged perpetrator group, shows that Israel has intentionally and systematically deprived the civilian population in all parts of Gaza of objects indispensable to human survival. So it's not a simple reliance, as you depicted, of UN testimony.
I think the UN testimony, I suspect, is very crucial to the appreciation of the facts. Let me give you an example of what happened in a known case concerning Israel's security barrier in the West Bank. When it came to the International Court of Justice, the International Court of Justice relied, amongst other things, on the fact that there had been a 40% drop in caseload in the UN hospital in the town called Qalqilya. And it said this was an example of how terrible the walls, the barriers' effect had been on that town. But then when the matter came before the Israeli Supreme Court, further evidence was adduced, which showed that two new hospitals had opened up in the town of Qalqilya. And this had obviously had an effect on the caseload of the UN hospital. So this does show how, to a suspicious mind, the basic facts can be interpreted in a completely different way, in a completely wrong way.
And I acknowledge
I've seen
that.
This approach in lots of other UN reports about Israel. Mm-hmm.
If I can for a moment, with due respect, turn that label onto you. You obviously have a suspicious mind in relation to the International Criminal Court. Let's discuss the evidence that they seem to have collected here, that they say they have collected. 2 days after the Hamas attacks on October the 7th, Yoav Gallant, Israel's defence minister, said, I have ordered a complete siege on the Gaza Strip. There will be no electricity, no food, no fuel. Everything is closed. We're fighting human animals and we're acting accordingly. That is the type of evidence that they're relying on, as well as evidence in terms of starvation within Gaza, when they put these allegations forward.
Yes, well, first of all, that policy was not followed through. Very soon after that, various supplies were restored. But when it comes to electricity, that is, of course, used by Hamas to ensure that its tunnels throughout the Gaza Strip, from which it attacks Israel, from which it launches its missiles and so on, those tunnels have to be ventilated to be usable, and they're ventilated by electric fans. And the instruments, the launch machinery that pops up out of the ground through the shafts to launch the missiles, that's also powered by electricity. So Israel had very good grounds not to.
It was followed through on, wasn't it? There's acute starvation in Gaza right now.
Absolutely. If there are lots of people have mobile phones in the Gaza Strip, that's quite evident. We have not seen lots of pictures of people with emaciated or with swollen bellies.
Yes, we have.
From starvation. We haven't. There were a few babies that were abandoned in a hospital that starved to death, unfortunately due to the dislocation of war and the fact that Hamas use hospitals as military bases. The hospital had to be evacuated and babies were left behind.
Why did the hospital have to be evacuated?
And in another case, there was a child who had some congenital problem and required very special food, and that wasn't available. But there was no general starvation, and there hasn't been a general starvation.
Can I ask you, why do you know did that hospital have to be evacuated?
Because of it was harbouring, because it was being used by Hamas.
On September the 20th, Israel submitted an official challenge to this request from the International Criminal Court prosecutor for an arrest warrant against its Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. There were many international protests about the war in Gaza from May to July, and back in May, there were fierce clashes at many US college campuses over Gaza, including this one at the University of California.
Now, hundreds of police wearing helmets moved into a central plaza of the University of California at Los Angeles this morning in a move to disperse a pro-Palestinian protest camp. The pre-dawn police crackdown at UCLA marked the latest flashpoint for mounting tensions on U.S. college campuses, where protests over Israel's conduct of the war in Gaza have led to student clashes with each other and law enforcement. Well, earlier today, before we came on air, I spoke to Will Carlos, who's a reporter with USA Today, who was at the scene, and I began by asking him what exactly was happening on the ground there.
So yeah, I've been here since about 5 o'clock yesterday evening. Basically, the police have been sort of stationed around the camp for the last, well, since about 5 o'clock yesterday. And about an hour ago, they started to move in force. They have now been sort of systematically dismantling the main barricade that the protesters have put up. They've been firing flashbang shots above our heads for the last hour or so, which I'm sure you'll hear in a second. And they're basically lined up in a big row about to push into the camp itself and presumably start making arrests and sort of physically pushing people out of the plaza.
What are flashbang shots? What are they?
Basically, sort of, they're non-lethal ammunition that the police fire up into the air. They make a very loud banging noise. And I think their purpose is to sort of disorientate and scare people. And certainly the moment they started firing them, people started to leave. And as they've sort of pushed forwards and taken down the barricade, I'd estimate at this point about 4/5 maybe of the protesters have left, and just sort of a hardcore militant group remain.
And how many is that?
Oh, it's hard to tell because they're sort of bunched right up against the police. But I'd say at least a couple of hundred people. But I mean, to give that perspective, at the height of the protest, there were probably at least 1,000 people in the plaza itself, if not more.
And have you been speaking to any of the students there or the protesters, and what are they saying?
Sure. I mean, there's been a real air of bravado throughout the day. And in fact, the students scored a couple of wins throughout the day when there were sort of more minor police incursions where about 20 or 30 police officers pushed into the square. They were surrounded by students chanting peaceful protest and we're not scared. And the protesters were actually managed to sort of push the police out of the plaza.
On May 22nd, Ireland formally recognised the State of Palestine, which drew a negative reaction from Israel and the withdrawal of the Israeli ambassador to Ireland. We hear now from a former Israeli legislator, Enet Wilf.
Now, first this afternoon, as Cormac mentioned there, Ireland, along with Norway and Spain, has formally recognised the State of Palestine. Taoiseach Simon Harris said it had been the long-standing position of Ireland that a two-state solution is the way to bring peace. The move was welcomed by the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, the PLO, and also by Hamas. Israel reacted angrily, saying it sends a message to the Palestinians and the world that terrorism pays. It recalled its ambassadors to Ireland Ireland, Spain and Norway for consultations, warning of further severe consequences. But first, shortly before coming on air, I got reaction from Dr. Aned Wilf, who's a member of the Israeli Parliament from 2010 to 2013. And I began by asking her for the reaction in Israel to Ireland's decision.
In Israel, most people don't care. Most people think of Ireland as a deeply hostile country to Israel anyway. So from that perspective, it changes nothing.
And does it change nothing that Spain and Norway have also decided to recognize Palestine?
A little bit more, but again, it's not really a major issue of concern here. It's considered part of a general hostile attitude of those countries and those specific governments.
Does it surprise you that the Israeli government was, I suppose, enough concerned about it to recall their ambassador from Ireland today?
No, it's their traditional mode of operation whenever a country recognizes Palestine.
Our Deputy Prime Minister, Micheál Martin, and he's also the Minister for Foreign Affairs here, he said he believed that today's announcement will add and support the Arab Peace Initiative. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely not. That is disingenuous at best, ignorant, or malicious at worst.
For this podcast, we sat down with UNRWA's spokesperson Julia Tuma to reflect on the humanitarian crisis caused by the year of war in Gaza and also what's the future for the territory.
We might just start then with I suppose, your reflections on the year that's been, because we've spoken to you a number of times over the last year on Drive Time, and I suppose each time maybe more difficult than the last.
Oh, absolutely. Well, first of all, to say that it is beyond comprehension that we are still having these conversations 1 year down the line, and that the international community and the parties to the conflict have failed to reach an agreement for a ceasefire. And yes, you're absolutely right. Every day we think that we've hit rock bottom, except we're proven wrong. Every day is more awful than the day before. And in terms of the devastation and the scale and the volume and the speed and the impact that this war has had on our agency, on UNRWA, it's also unprecedented, whether it's the number of our colleagues who were killed, over 220, whether it's the buildings of the UN that were hit, some of them several times, whether it's the mass humanitarian operation that continues to face challenges and constraints.
Has this conflict changed how you see the world, Juliet?
Look, I've been working in conflicts for over two decades now, and it is safe to say that this is the toughest conflict I've ever covered or worked on or in. Again, it has to do with the scale and the volume and the impact that this war has had on people, on civilians in Gaza, and the restrictions on our humanitarian operation, and also dehumanization, the inability to sympathize with the other side and the inability to see the other side as human. In that sense, that is very, very difficult and in fact quite shocking.
Right now, a lot of attention focused on what's happening in the north of Israel and in southern Lebanon, and less attention on Gaza. What is it like in Gaza right now?
Meanwhile, the war in Gaza continues and the destruction continues and the military operations continue. And with that comes civilian casualties, including among UNRWA staff. With that come attacks on civilian infrastructure, including facilities. I mean, just this week, we had yet another school that was hit. We had yet another UNRWA clinic that was hit. So the devastating situation and escalation that we are seeing in Lebanon, it has not brought any lull to the people of Gaza.
And can I ask you finally, Juliet, we've been hearing over the past few episodes of this podcast about people starting to go hungry, then people being hungry, and the destruction of the health facilities and the lack of medical supplies and the lack of aid, humanitarian aid getting into the Gaza Strip. Do all those problems persist, or has anything improved?
They do persist. And this is, I think, what is very, very sad and very shocking, is that 1 year down the line, we're still speaking about the lack of basic supplies, the lack of medicines, the lack of safety. I think this is the most important aspect. 1 year down the line, we're still advocating for that. Our calls are falling on deaf ears. No place is safe. People continue to flee from one place to another. We've not seen an improvement in the flow of supplies. And it is long overdue to have a ceasefire that will bring respite to the people of Gaza, to the people of Israel, whether they're in the south or in the north, given the recent escalation in Lebanon. Respite to the people of Lebanon after so many decades of turmoil and conflict, and that the people in the region are very, very tired. It is absolutely critical that there is a deal that would bring a ceasefire, and that ceasefire will bring respite to the people of Gaza, to people in Israel, that would also release all hostages in Gaza, that will also bring much needed humanitarian basic supplies to the people of Gaza. Gaza has become unfit for humans.
Juliet, thank you so much for joining us again this evening and for speaking to us throughout the year.
Thank you for listening to episode 3 of Drive Time In Depth, The War in Gaza. In the final episode tomorrow, we'll track the war from August to the present day, with ceasefire talks breaking down and the deadly conflict spreading from Gaza to the West Bank and Lebanon.
The War in Gaza is produced by Drive Time series producer Will Hanafin and presented by me, Cormac O'Hara.
And me, Sarah McInerney.